Now, please be seated. We're back in session. The Chief Justice is not participating in this case. The case is Henderson v. Vessels, number 12SC198. There's 15 minutes to decide here. Counsel, both have that. If you would please, when you identify yourself, start and who you are and who you are. By the way, some of us are using iPads, some of us are. The Chief Justice always says we're using iPads. I've got the old fashioned.
I'm still struggling to get transitioned into the new era, Your Honor, so I'm sympathetic. May it please the court, I am Andrew Lowe, counsel for the petitioner, Alva Hickerson. The Court of Appeals held that Mr. Hickerson could not assert his defense of latches because he violated separation of powers. The Court of Appeals reasoned that if this lawsuit was timely under the statute of limitations, it could not be held untimely due to the plaintiff's latches. Allowing latches in this case, however, would not violate separation of powers because there is no conflict between judicial and legislative action. I first want to discuss the separation of powers point, then move on to the law equity distinction, and finally talk about Vessels' public policy argument. So, separation of powers point. It is undisputed that this lawsuit would not have been timely under the statutes that provide for the 6-year statute of limitations. Those statutes provide that the statutory period began running in 1999 when the promissory note was due and expired 6 years later in 2005. Vessels did not bring suit until 4 years later in 2009. In order to make his lawsuit timely, Vessels turns to the partial payment doctrine, which holds that a partial payment of principal or interest by the debtor serves to restart the statute of limitations. Vessels argues that the monthly payments, partial payments, that were made by the Louisiana oil and gas operator invoked this doctrine and restarted the statute of limitations every month. The problem with this, though, is that the partial payment rule is a common law rule. You cannot find in any statute a rule that says if the debtor makes a partial payment of principal or interest, then the statute of limitations will restart. And because it is a common law period of time that is started under the partial payment rule, when latches is applied to that extended time, we have a judicial defense latches cutting short a period of time started by a common law rule.
So you're saying the common law rule still applies and the partial payment rule is good under your interpretation that latches should apply to it?
Well, as you know, our alternate argument for reversal is that the district court erred in applying the partial payment rule at all. But under my first argument, which has occupied most of the briefs, I'm assuming for present purposes that the partial payment rule would apply. And if so, if it doesn't apply at all, then the case is over.
Okay, well, what are you really arguing?
My first point is that if the partial payment rule applies, there's no separation of powers violation because the partial payment rule is common law, not statutory. Therefore, latches was applied to a common law period of time, not statutory period of time.
Did you think the Court of Appeals was seeing that as not an equitable or common law doctrine, but rather whether it was common law or not, a construction of the statute, and would that change matters?
Certainly the Court of Appeals said that. But, Your Honor, I would submit that there is no way to construe the statute of limitations statute to restart over and over again. There is not a word, not a hint, not a whisper in the 103.5 and 108, the two statutes here that govern the 6-year statute of limitations. And quite the contrary, those statutes provide that any of the following actions, and lists various ones, including this one, an action on the promissory note, shall be asserted within 6 years and not thereafter. That's what the statute says, 103.5. I don't see any way to interpret that language to come up with the partial payment rule. The partial payment rule instead has been recognized by this court in the Van Diest case as judicial legislation by the English courts going back now 400 years. And there is no argument really by the other side either. They have not even attempted to uphold the statement by the Court of Appeals that the common, that the partial payment rule is just an interpretation of the statute. So it's really a common law rule. Now, Fessels, I think, doesn't expect anyone to believe that it's not a common law rule in its inception. And he admits that, that it was invented by the courts. So he goes on to his next position, which is that this common law rule, partial payment rule, has been converted into statutory form because it was mentioned in a couple of statutes. Well, we obviously disagree with that. The statutes that he relies on are 1380.113 et seq, which 1380.113 applies to acknowledgments of debts. In general speaking, there are two ways to restart the statute of limitations in a promissory note case. One, as we know, is for the debtor to make a partial payment of interest or principal. The other way is if the debtor acknowledges the debt. And Section 113 simply says that if the debtor acknowledgments be given legal force, that that acknowledgment has to be in writing and signed by the debtor. Okay, that doesn't apply here. Now, that's not the part that doesn't arise. What he points to is the next clause of the statute, which says this rule concerning acknowledgments doesn't apply to payments of principal or interest. It says, but this section shall not alter the effect of a payment of principal or interest. And he says that that kind of a sidelong reference is sufficient to convert the common law rule to the statutory rule. And we obviously disagree. That does not restate the rule. The rule itself is not contained in that language. You can't discover the rule there. And all it is really saying is, on the part of the legislature, if I can paraphrase broadly, is we're making a rule about acknowledgments. We know there's another court-made rule about partial payments. Whatever that is, this statute doesn't apply to those. Now, that does not adopt the partial payment rule. And Vessels also points to Section 115, two sections later, which places evidentiary limits on how a creditor may prove that a partial payment has actually been made. And what it says is that the creditor may not rely on his unilateral act in endorsing the payment or making a memorandum of the payment. In other words, essentially, if the bank is suing to collect on a loan, the bank can't simply rely on its own accounting system to show that a partial payment was made. Now, does this adopt, I should say that that statute does also refer to the partial payment doctrine. But does it adopt the partial payment doctrine? Absolutely not. It does not state the rule of the partial payment doctrine. Instead, I would suggest that far from adopting or approving the partial payment rule, Section 115, which limits the way it can be proved, expresses skepticism and potential disapproval of the partial payment rule. Because legislature is saying, we think maybe it's too easy for creditors to prove partial payments, and so we're going to limit the kind of proof. We're going to make them come out with better proof than just their own bookkeeping records. So that seems to me to be, if anything, a little bit on the skeptical side, certainly not expressing approval or adoption.
But nonetheless, Mr. Lowe, it does seem to be talking about the partial payment rule, and that's the conundrum.
Yes. Your Honor, you're absolutely right, it does talk about it. And the analogy that I would draw here would be the common law doctrine of negligence, simple negligence, a common law rule, no doubt. And yet the term negligence is mentioned in innumerable Colorado statutes. Mentioning negligence, and even adopting rules about apparent fault and sharing fault and non-parties and so on, none of those mentions adopts negligence, makes it statutory, and prohibits the courts from making common law rules about negligence sections.
You've got only about 6 minutes left here. I'd be interested in knowing why, since Latches, let's assume for a moment that it may apply. Latches is an equitable document, right?
Yes. So
tell me why Latches should apply under the facts of this case.
Very simply because the distinction between law and equity was abolished explicitly by the legislature in 1877, and then that statute and its amended versions of it have followed down to the present and is now contained in CRCP 8E2, which contains language almost identical to the 1877 statute. And what it says is that a defendant may assert any defense that he may have, whether legal or equitable. And so, as you point out, latches is indeed a defense that originated in the courts of equity, but the statute wiped out a substantive distinction between legal defenses and equitable defenses.
But it's very unusual that a court of law applies latches, right? So why does it apply in this case?
Well, I mean, it's unusual only in the sense that, I mean, the issue has not been decided, which is, I think, why we're here. There is not very much authority on that point. There is, of course, a departmental decision of this court, White versus Widger, that goes back a century or so, with only three justices, which says that latches does apply. But we don't have a en banc decision of this court. But what we do have is a whole series of decisions by this court which reject over and over again arguments that a defense cannot be asserted to a legal claim merely because it originated in the courts of equity. Now that is exactly the argument that Vestas is making here, that the Court of Appeals tiptoed up to, but really never adopted. In order to hold that latches is not applicable because it is equitable, I suggest that there would be, in that decision, a conflict with the 1877 statute, a conflict with Rule 82, and it would act as essentially overruling, at least in part, a long history of decisions to the contrary by this court. I've cited seven such decisions in my opening brief at pages 15 to 17.
Counsel, can I just understand your argument? I'm sorry, you only have 3 minutes left, but I mean, essentially you're arguing that the partial payment doctrine doesn't exist anyway. Correct? I mean, you're...
No, I'm arguing that the partial payment doctrine is a common law rule, not a statutory rule.
Okay. So if it's common law rule, then essentially there should be a sort of judge-made defense. I mean, is that what you're seeing latches as? I know you're using equitable, and I know we've described it, but I'm trying to hook that up with your argument with regard to the partial payment doctrine.
I would like to keep separate the argument on separation of powers, where the status of a rule as common law or statutory makes a great deal of difference, on the one hand, and on the other hand, discussion of law and equity, which I think has no effect on this case because it's been abolished by statute and later by rule. So the partial payment doctrine is common law, and because it's common law, the only way that Vestas' lawsuit was timely was because the statute of limitations is extended by a common law doctrine. And therefore, if we apply another non-statutory, let's say, doctrine to cut short that time period, all we're doing is applying one judicial doctrine to another judicial doctrine. And that is definitely not a violation of separation of powers. That's my argument there.
Thank you.
Okay. I have 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and I'd like to reserve the rest for both. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you. Counsel? Your name and who you represent, please, for the record. And you can raise that podium right there a little bit. Yeah.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Nicholas McKeever. I represent Respondent Thomas Vestas. To very, very briefly put this issue before the court in context, petitioner borrowed money in a commercial transaction and didn't repay it. He owes the debt. That issue was decided by the trial court after trial on merits based on the evidence. That is unchallenged at this point. The only question is whether a petitioner should be denied a judgment on that debt because this case was filed too late, even though it was not barred by the statute of limitations. To avoid judgment, petitioner invites this court to go where no Colorado decision has ever gone before and apply latches to bar a legal claim that is not barred by the statute of limitations. There is no precedent for that belief, and there are good reasons for not granting it today. In Colorado's modern system of jurisprudence, civil claims are universally governed by statutes of limitations. These statutes reflect a legislative policy judgment as to what is a reasonable time for bringing a claim, and they establish that time as a matter of law. Latches, on the other hand, was developed in English chancery courts where there were no statutes of limitations and where relief was granted or denied based on the grace and indulgence of the chancellor bishop, not as a matter of legal right. Now that law and equity have merged to permit latches to serve as a backup basis for determining whether a case has been timely filed in our modern system, effectively giving trial judges the ability to overrule the statute of limitations, it would not be sound law or policy. It would be duplicative and contradictory, it would violate separation of powers, and it would create uncertainty and foster additional litigation, which is exactly what statutes of limitations are intended to avoid.
Counsel, could I get you to directly address your opponent's main argument, which is the only reason you have a claim in this case is that you took advantage of a common law doctrine, the partial payment doctrine, and that therefore a common law sort of defense to that latches should be able to be raised?
Yes. Undoubtedly, we do not disagree that the partial payment doctrine originated in the common law in England. But in England, Lord Tenterden's Act, which was 1828, as we discussed in the brief, and subsequently in most states, including Colorado, statutes have recognized the partial payment doctrine. And we strongly disagree with petitioner's arguments and Judge Hoffman's rationale below that this is simply, at this point, a judge-made rule and with no legislative involvement. The Court of Appeals, in its decision, discussed Section 1381.13. That section is essentially a statute of frauds, requiring a new or continuing contract to be written in order to extend the statute of limitations. But that section then states, it shall not alter the effect of a payment of principal or interest. That, at the very least, acknowledges the partial payment rule and shows an intent to have it continue to apply. But beyond that, sections 114 and 115 and 116 show more legislative involvement in defining and limiting the partial payment rule. Section 114 provides that one joint obligor's payment shall not cause another joint obligor to lose the bar of the statute of limitations. That is a substantive rule limiting the partial payment rule. Section 1381.16, conversely, and perhaps even more tellingly, provides that even if a claim against one joint obligor is barred under the statute of limitations, the plaintiff, quote, shall be entitled to proceed, end quote, as against another joint obligor who has made a new acknowledgement or promise or payment. That is an affirmative legislative declaration of the partial payment rule. The plaintiff shall be entitled to proceed if a payment has been made. And these sections, I would note, are not separate from the rest of the statute of limitations. They are sections within section, within Article 13, Chapter 80, which is headed Limitation of Actions. They are part and parcel of it, and they expressly recognize in these four sections the partial payment rule. And they have done so since 1868, before Colorado was a state. So it is a legislatively recognized rule and has been forever in Colorado.
Could I ask you, especially with regard to accrual, the way that limitations are set up, and we recognize this in a number of cases, they set the limit by setting a time period from the point of accrual, and then they deal with accrual in various cases.
Yes.
The doctrine here, partial payment, as I understand it, is a long established doctrine that deals with the point of accrual. Is there anything in the statute dealing with accrual for this kind of a case that would indicate one way or the other anything about the partial payment doctrine?
I don't think there is in the statute, Your Honor. You know, we've argued in our brief that it is a reasonable way to construe the entire statutory scheme to find that a partial payment causes a new accrual of the six-year period. I think that it's not necessary to find that that's the case. You know, the way the rule developed originally and the way it is recognized in the case law is that it restarts the statute of limitations. And that's really the point, is that it is a doctrine legislatively recognized in these statutes that restarts the statute of limitations. And so we disagree with the argument that this case was not filed within the statute of limitations. It absolutely was, when you look at the entire article and construe all these provisions together.
So when the legislature set a time limit of six years for this kind of collection on a promissory note, and said 6 years from the point of accrual, as far as you can tell, they just said nothing with regard to the point of accrual that would indicate one way or another whether they intended an accrual period to start again after each partial payment.
I agree with that. I think the statutes are a bit anomalous in that sense. The statute begins to run on accrual, but you also do have this partial payment rule, which has been as long pre-existed the modern statutes with their accrual language. I just don't think that it was directly addressed.
Would you remind us why there weren't demands for payment here?
I'm sorry?
There, let's talk about the equities. Apparently were not demands for payment made. There's a large amount accumulated to the debt.
I don't think there is much evidence on why that was done.
Why is that?
Along. Mr. Vessels is deceased. His wife, who was his personal representative, is also deceased. There just isn't any explanation in the record about why.
And how much money we're talking about?
The current principal amount of the debt is $385,000.
Right. A sizable amount.
Yes.
Somehow it got lost?
I don't know the answer to that. Okay. But the case was filed within the statute of
limitations. But it's the heirs now of the state that are, in effect, out? If the debt can't be collected?
Correct.
Yeah.
Counsel, could I ask you to perhaps clarify for me whether your argument hinges more on the concept that because you view the partial payment doctrine as having been codified in statute, you can't assert an equitable defense against what is otherwise a statutory bar here? Or is it truly the separation of powers argument that the Court of Appeals relies on? And where I'm going with this is I'm trying to understand how the concept of equitable tolling might work to extend the statute of limitations through a judge-made doctrine. And if the Court of Appeals here has concluded that to shorten a statutory limit would violate separation of powers, does that mean that logically equitable tolling would do the same? I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yes, I think it can, and I think this court has recognized that equitable tolling can.
In every instance, simply because it would run afoul of the statutory.
I'm sorry?
In every instance, and at least any time. I mean, tolling seems to necessarily imply a statute of limitations that we're extending.
Yes. I think what the court has said is that if equitable tolling conflicts with a statutory provision, either limiting equitable tolling or otherwise conflicting with that principle, then it's not appropriate for the court to go there. And I've discussed the separation of powers argument, but that's not the only reason why applying latches in this situation is inappropriate. The historical distinction between law and equity does make a difference here. The petitioner has argued that it's irrelevant. The abolishment of the distinction between law and equity did not just open the door to willy-nilly abandon any distinction between the substantive differences between legal and equitable claims and defenses. The two systems, matches and statutes of limitations, developed in separate courts and in separate legal systems. Latches in the Chancery Courts, statutes of limitations were applied in the courts of law, and even after statutes of limitation were begun to be enacted, latches continued to apply in the Chancery Courts because the statutes didn't apply there. With the merger of law and equity, combined with the almost universal application of statutes of limitations, which we have now in Colorado, latches' historical basis for applying to determine the timeliness of filing their claims has disappeared. What it is now, instead of filling the void where the statutes didn't apply, it is a duplicative, if anything, if it wasn't a case like this, it is a backup sort of system for determining, you know, in a particular case, if the judge determines that even if it's filed within the statute of limitations, that's too much delay. That's what it amounts to. The problem with the duplication is that, and why it's important, is that the two concepts are completely inconsistent. The statute of limitations exists to provide a time certain for filing a claim. Latches developed in equity, where everything was subject to the chancellor's discretion, is intentionally flexible and necessarily uncertain. And more important, most important, the conflict between the two is direct. In both instances, you have a determination of what is a reasonable time for filing a case. If you have a statute, the legislature has waived the policies of repose versus what's a reasonable time for allowing a claim, and it has determined what that time should be. In the case of latches, you have a court deciding based on whatever the factors may be to appeal to the judge in a particular case, what was reasonable or unreasonable about the delay in bringing the case. So they are not only duplicative, but they are contradictory in the approach they take and what they attempt to do. And that leads to the separation of powers concern, which I've already discussed. The last argument that I'd like to address is the mess that we would have if latches applies to cut off a statute of limitations shorter than the statutory period. This point is fairly obvious, I don't need to belabor it, but statutes of limitations are a legislative determination that certainty is important. Adding latches into that mix completely undermines that paramount policy that statutes
are limitations. Especially in a commercial context, right?
Absolutely.
Counsel, can I just, I know you want to finish up on that, but I'm wondering if you could address your opposing counsel's alternate argument that partial payment doctrine should not have been applied here at all.
Your Honor, most strongly, I would suggest that issue is not properly before the court. It was not raised in the Court of Appeals. The trial court ruled against Mr. Hickerson on that issue. That argument was not made in the Court of Appeals. It was not argued to this court in the petition for certiorari. Not a word was mentioned about that. In fact, the reply brief in support of certiorari said this, quote, "This state needs a clear ruling on whether or not a claim that is not barred by the statute of limitations can be barred by latches." That is how petitioner claimed.
And I understand. I understand the raising wasn't raised, but can I ask you, just, do you have a position on the argument?
Absolutely. The trial court made findings that Hickerson authorized the well operator to make payments, the partial payments that were made. Those payments were made directly to Mr. Vessels Sr. as authorized by Mr. Hickerson. They were his agents for making the payment, and therefore, the payments fall directly within the partial payment rule. Those findings were supported by substantial evidence in the record. There's very little basis to dispute that. And they were consistent with Colorado law, which recognizes the partial payment rule and that the partial payments can be through an agent.
Was Mr. Dickerson in a position to stop those payments at any point, having delegated that authority?
I think that the note was, or the authorization was irrevocable, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for your argument.
Thank you.
And we'll take on that 45 seconds in Mr. Lowe's time here.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start off with what I think is the key concept, which is highlighted by my opponent's argument. And that is that this case is not about whether latches can be applied to shorten the statutory period as set forth in the statute of limitations. The holding in this case should not address that, and it's not presented. And the brief and much of the argument was framed or phrased as though that were the issue. If you go to the two statutes that specify the statute of limitations, they are crystal clear that the statute of limitations started. Justice Coates asked about the accrual statute. That is 1380.108 sub 4. And it provides that the cause of action on the statute, or on a promissory note, accrues when the debt becomes due. And this promissory note specifies that it was due on April 13th, 1999. There just cannot be any ambiguity about that. And then the 103.5 statute in the same section provides that the statutory period is 6 years. So on its face, the statutes of limitations say that the statute expired in April of 2005, 4 years before Vessels brought suit. What we are really talking about is when the statutory period is extended by a non-statutory doctrine, can that extended period be cut short by another non-statutory doctrine latches? And that seems symmetrical and equitable to me. On equity, I would like to briefly address Justice Hobbs' point. The total amount owing, you may notice that in response to your question, opposing counsel said the total amount of principal was in the $300,000 range. The total amount of principal and interest is in the range of $1 million currently claimed by Vessels. I'd like to now skip over to one of the statutes that counsel referred to, and that was the 116 statute, 1380.116. And he talked about how it involved joint debtors. And he claimed that it actually states the partial payment rule. It does not. What it says is that if there are joint obligors, and if the claim is barred against one but not barred against the other, then the creditor can proceed against the one as to whom it's not barred. But if the whole statute is preceded by if, and so what is the if referring to? It's referring to the common law doctrine of partial payments, if partial payments. And similarly, in 113, that statute talks about the effect of a partial payment, it never states what that effect is. And I think you can see this all the way through these statutes, that they are referring to the common law doctrine, but not itself adopted. If this kind of a passing reference to a common law doctrine was sufficient to adopt it and make it so that the courts could not do anything further with it, this court, I would suggest, would be giving away a portion of its constitutionally granted authority, to the point where all the legislature has to do is mention a magic word, negligence, or in this case, partial payments, and magically, all of a sudden, the courts are deprived of jurisdiction to decide cases in that area, applying common law defenses, equitable defenses. And I suggest that is an overstatement of the separation of powers doctrine.
Can that language also be read, you think, to indicate that the legislature assumes or accepts that doctrine does define the accrual date on a promissory note, and therefore they don't have to say more about it?
Well, excuse me, the legislature, of course, knows how to adopt and state the principle itself if it wants to. And it has done that in many, many statutes. Here, by simply referring to the statute as a third party existing out there, I suggest that it was refraining from doing that. And I would also suggest that as a body, these statutes show the legislature's skepticism about the partial payment rule and desire to limit it, not approval or adoption. Thank you.
Would you got anything more to say, or you wrapped it up? Would you finish, please?
I'm finished, sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're going to stand in a short recess here while we collect our chief. Thank you.